Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the great creators early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hey, everyone, I want to let you know that we will be back next week with a brand new episode of The Great Creators. It's my interview with the co-creator and star of Ted Lasso, Jason Sudeikis. He talks about bringing that character to life, the way it's affected his own self-image, and about the line between Ted's struggles on screen and turmoil in Jason's personal life. You won't want to miss it. But until then, I want to bring you this really awesome interview from our archive. It's with acting legend Sigourney Weaver. Enjoy. From Built It Productions, it's The Great Creators. Conversations about creativity with some of the most celebrated actors, musicians, and performers of our time. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how one of the most acclaimed actors of her generation almost didn't act.
So I remember going to the career placement person and trying to take a test to figure out what I'd be good at. And the lady kept saying, but I think you really should be somewhere in show business. And I said, no, I really am not interested in that. I really would much rather work in some nice place like a florist store or a bakery, or even I could be a bank teller. So even though I wasn't making any money, I could be handing people money.
How Sigourney Weaver overcame her self-doubt and helped pave the way for other women to play action hero roles. Sigourney Weaver's character in the 1979 film Alien was groundbreaking. Before she played Ellen Ripley, it was extremely rare to see a female action hero on screen. And Sigourney Weaver seemed to embody that character in every way. Strong, self-assured, tough, and confident. It was a role she seemed born to play, and she kind of was. She came from a show business family. Her mother trained at the Royal Academy in London and went on to a career in Hollywood, and Sigourney's father was president of NBC in the 1950s, and then went on to found one of the first American cable companies. But in her early years, Sigourney questioned whether she had what it takes to pursue a career in acting. Today, of course, she's widely considered to be one of the great actors of her generation, along with Meryl Streep and Glenn Close. She's made more than 60 films and has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards. In my conversation with Sigourney Weaver, you'll hear about how she overcame that self-doubt in her early years, about how the pioneering character she brought to life in Alien, Ellen Ripley, was originally written for a man, and about why the roles she's getting today are very different than what women actors were being offered when she was starting out. That's all coming up after this break.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Sigourney Weaver spent her early years in New York City. As a child, she was bookish, awkward, and even shy. And one reason she was so uncomfortable in her own skin was that she stood out in a pretty obvious way.
When I hit 11, I was suddenly very tall, and it's an age where you kind of want to hide anyway, so that my chance of hiding 5 feet 10 and a half inches was more challenging. So I think I was probably, like many, many kids that age, very self-conscious, already pretty shy. I remember that pretty vividly.
Well, one thing people may not know about you is you were not born Sigourney. That is a name you gave yourself, not for the stage or the screen, but as a child. I think your given name was Susan Alexandra Weaver, right?
I know. I was so tall, I wanted a longer name because, of course, if your name is Susan, people call you Susie, which is a kind of a cute little name. And I don't think I felt cute or little. And so I was, I was a big reader. I was quite a bookworm, and I was reading The Great Gatsby. And Jordan Baker's aunt, who's only mentioned once, but she had this long, interesting-looking name, Sigourney. And I just remember looking at this name thinking, this looks like the name for me. I'm going to graduate to this name. I don't know what I was thinking. I look back on it with, wonder, but I was quite determined that I didn't want to be Susie anymore. I didn't feel like a Susie. I didn't feel grand enough to be Alexandra. That would have been maybe an easier move, my middle name, but that seemed problematic because it was so, so classy. And so Sigourney, at least it was original. I didn't know anyone else who had it, and I thought I'll just take care of this name. And I thought it was also funny that there was a record out by Noel Coward called Zigeuner about a gypsy. And I thought they might have the same root. I don't know if that's true. And I thought, that sounds great. I'd like to be a gypsy.
From what I've read about you, you were quite an academic kid. And I know for high school, you went to an all-girls boarding school in the East Coast. And you were studious. You did well there, right?
I loved reading, and I had a wonderful English teacher at the school I went to. My parents had moved to California to start this cable television company, and so I had an opportunity to either go to the local high school or go away to school. And I remember I met some girls from the class I would have joined at the local high school, and they were so incredibly sophisticated. They wore makeup, they had very nice clothes, one girl confided to me that she washed her bangs every night so that she would look nice for the boys in the class. And this was so far from who I was, who was the 6-foot-tall, nose-in-a-book girl. And I ran to the other extreme, which was an all-girls school in Connecticut, where we had the most amazing women teachers who had really sacrificed their lives, their personal lives, to devote themselves to teaching girls, because girls' education was still, at that time in the 50s, something that was, it was still new. It was still, we're still fighting for this idea that girls should be taught real science and things like that. And I had the most wonderful teacher named Miss Hunt, who encouraged my love of writing and encouraged my love of reading plays and took me to the Hartford Stage Company a couple of times. And I think it was really Miss Hunt who gave me the feeling that I had something to say that perhaps was different, that I had perhaps a way of looking at characters, a way in that deserved to be nurtured. And this was completely thrilling to me. I felt something in me ignite because of her support, her interest.
When did you, given that you sort of describe yourself as kind of awkward and shy, maybe it's not surprising, but to me it seems surprising that you gravitated towards theater in high school, right? Because you would think that sort of somebody who felt awkward and shy would not want to be on stage in the spotlight. How did you sort of begin to move towards theater as a high school student?
I think many actors are shy. Mm. And it's our way of sort of
breaking through it, or sort of
breaking through it, or getting around it. You know, that when we're, you know, playing bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream, and we have an ass's head on, that something else comes out of us.
Yeah,
I think it has a lot to do with shyness. That actors perhaps feel freer when they have a mask on of another person or character. But I didn't really do much theater in high school. I was head of the drama club, but we didn't do much theater, period. And so it wasn't until I got to college at Stanford that I started to... I didn't want to be part of the theater department, which looked quite fussy to me, and wrapped in mothballs. But I did want to be part of this very exciting group of young actors who wanted to do, you know, Shakespeare and Commedia dell'arte and new plays. And, you know, we directed ourselves. No one was telling us what to do. We didn't have a theater. We did it wherever we could. And so that really was the first time I was able to direct my joy in playing other people into an actual form instead of just kind of wondering about it. So I think it wasn't really till college, and even then I never would have said to you, oh, I want to be an actor. Hmm. Because coming from my family where there were so many professional actors and musicians and...
Right, your mom, I think your uncle also was a comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would never have had the nerve to say, I belong on that level. Hmm. So I kind of backed into acting. I was interested in lots of different things like journalism, and I was interested in people. I observed people. I found people fascinating. So I kind of backed into it, and it took me many years, probably till I was in my mid-20s, before I would say, I want a career in acting. I probably would have told you, no, I want to work in a bake shop.
I want to ask you a bit more about your time at Stanford, because you were an English major there, and this theater trip that you were involved in, you know, while you were there, you mentioned it a moment ago, I think it was called the Palo Alto Company. It was like sort of like a guerrilla performance group, and you guys would put on like all these plays in all kinds of informal settings from what I've read. And it sounds like it was a pretty like colorful group of people, and this sort of time in your life was pretty formative for you, right?
Well, I think it was a very political time in the early 70s, the Vietnam War.
Sure.
So the guerrilla theater I was doing was mostly on campus, and it was all anti-war protests. I was an English major. I feel that my study of all the classics, all the writing I did then, all the sort of analysis and breaking down of structure and all these kind of English nerdy things have been extremely helpful to my being able to evaluate a script. And I feel like that was something my high school gave me, this sense of comfort with my own, you know, I don't feel I need to ask someone else's opinion of a script. I kind of pretty much feel the structure, what it's about, the themes. I do all that sort of in my stomach. And so I'm so grateful for my education, which was so, so drenched in literature. Who would have thought that I would use it every day of my life? And I have.
Yeah. You, of course, I mean, decided to pursue this profession. But even I think up until the last moment when you were an undergraduate, it wasn't clear that you were going to pursue acting. But you decided to apply to study drama and theater, and you ended up studying at Yale. Was that, I mean, in your mind, if you go back and think about where your head was it just something to do, sort of the next step? You were 20, 21, 22, or was it like, okay, I'm going to throw myself into this. This is what I want to do, and this is what I want to be.
Oh, no, it certainly wasn't the second. It was, I don't want to have to go ask my father for a job working at some television network in San Diego. I want to do something on my own. What is it I can do? What do I enjoy? And at the last minute, I ran around and auditioned for drama schools. I enjoyed the audition process. And I thought, this is more juicy to me than, you know, studying criticism of literature, which is where graduate school looked like it was going. And so I thought, oh, wow, what if I could actually go and be at a school where I was surrounded by other people who loved theater as much as I did? To me, it was going to be, I hoped, an extension of the joy I felt working with my friends in the company. It didn't turn out to be like that at all, but that was, I think, what I thought was, oh, I'd get to do this all the time. That's what I'd like to do. I don't think I had any thought that it would become my profession. So, again, I wasn't courageous enough to say, I want to be an actor.
Yeah.
That was not where I was at all.
Did you feel like, I mean, it's interesting because everything I've read about you suggests that you felt, have always felt in a certain sense, and maybe even continue to feel like a bit of an outsider. You know, I mean, one might look at you and say, well, how could she feel that way? She's had all of this success. But from what I've read, when you got there, you really felt like you didn't belong there, that the other students were better than you, or they were more refined or whatever it was, that you didn't feel like you belonged there.
I wouldn't call it that. I would say that none of us feel we belong there.
Yeah.
They made it very clear that we were very lucky to be there. And they would literally say things like, at the start of the year, they'd say, look left, look right, in a year one of you won't be here. So the whole atmosphere at Yale was very, you better do good because we took you here. It was never, ever, ever, we think you're talented and we're going to help you develop that talent. It was a very joyless atmosphere. I was surrounded by other people who adored the theater, and that's what made it livable. But I didn't like the atmosphere. It was very competitive for no reason. It's not as if the students were competitive with each other. We were all just trying to survive. And I've heard other people talk about art school as if this was also true in art school and architecture, and that they put everyone under this kind of pressure. And I remember thinking what a shame it was because, again, we all thought we'd be spending days, you know, arguing about Chekhov in the hallways and things like that. No, that was not what it was like. And they were hard on everybody. And I probably should have left.
What's kind of remarkable is you were there, I think, at the same time as Meryl Streep. I think she may have been a year or two ahead of you. And if you had gone there in the early 70s and just observed that group of actors, do you think people would have looked at you and Meryl Streep and said, these two are going to become these, you know, sort of groundbreaking actors who will define their generations?
Well, I certainly don't think they would have thought of that looking at me. But Meryl was always, you know, she had studied singing in high school, and she was sort of always on a different level. I think she was more professional when she got there. And in the individual shows, often you could really have fun. And so we were able to support each other. But no, I don't know what people would think. I look back at my classmates and think about how talented they were and how many of them were asked to leave or left because it was so discouraging. And I'm very sorry about that. I feel like art school should not be like that. That's just wrong.
Yeah. You also got to know somebody named Christopher Durang, who would become a well-known playwright in his own right at the time. And it would begin this, you would sort of develop this relationship where you would perform in many of his shows over the course of your career. When you left Yale, did you sort of think that you would then pursue a career in the theater? I mean, and by the way, you were really, I guess you were sort of known as a comedic actress at the time, right? Not a dramatic actress.
Well, luckily, I think what got me through was that I did do Chris Durang's work. We did his work in the Yale Cabaret, which was great fun, where I played a suicidal girl named Jenny and sang Better Dead Than Sorry while I gave myself shock treatments. Mm-hmm. I worked with Albert Inarrotto. I worked with Wendy Wasserstein. And the playwrights who were at Yale were so talented, and really working with them on new plays made me feel like maybe this was something I could do. So although I remember going to the career placement office at Yale, because I'd been so discouraged, I thought, well, if I'm this discouraged at school, I have no chance of having a career in real life. So I remember going to the career placement person and trying to take a test to figure out what I'd be good at. And the lady kept saying, but I think you really, with this background and your interests, you really should be somewhere in show business. And I said, no, I really am not interested in that. I really would much rather work, you know, in some nice place like a florist store or a bakery, or even I could be a bank teller. So even though I wasn't making any money, I could be handing people money. I really was not at all clear for a long time that I'd be able to make a living at this job. But I did know that I loved doing new plays with Chris. And Chris, Albert, Wendy, they saved me as an artist. They really did.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, how Sigourney Weaver went from avant-garde theater off Broadway to the lead role in Alien. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. So Sigourney Weaver graduates with a master's in fine arts from Yale in 1974 and immediately starts trying to make her way in the New York City theater world. She performs in plays written by her friend from Yale, Christopher Durang, but generally finding work becomes a real struggle. From what I understand, you had trouble getting roles in part because of your height, that agents or casting directors sort of looked at you and saw, you know, somebody who didn't quite fit what they needed or what they wanted. Is that true?
I'm sure that's true. You know, I never met any casting people. It's very difficult when you first come to New York, and I bet it's even harder now. All you had really were the open calls and your friends who would hire you to do off Broadway plays for a very short run at these theaters, which were in Hell's Kitchen, crumbling, unheated, etc. That's sort of where we did our work, and that was quite wonderful. The idea of just to even get in to see an agent was so difficult, and certainly agents couldn't figure out what to do with me because I was tall. And I was very good in some shows and got good reviews, but no one really would take me on. And honestly, maybe it was my height, or I think that the shows I was in, the people I was playing, like, you know, this girl in a sailor suit who had a hedgehog in her vagina, I think they could not figure out what role in real world I would be right for if this was what I like to do. And I don't, I'm not surprised.
And at this stage in your career, it seems like you weren't that interested in film. And I know you were offered a pretty significant role in Woody Allen's film Annie Hall, but I guess you turned it down because you wanted to focus on a play you were doing at the time. You did end up having a role in Annie Hall, very small one with no lines. Is it fair to say that you were not particularly interested in on-screen fame at that time?
I think I was interested in the adventure of what I was doing. Mm. I just loved what I was doing.
Yeah.
I hoped I could make a living at it, but I was not. I had parents who knew that it was a tough business. They didn't require me to get a job and show that I could make a living. You know, that would have made them happy probably. But you know, many people who are going into this business, their parents really want them to show that this is a viable career choice. I didn't have that pressure. And because I was working at the Public Theater, which to me was like the top, I wanted to stay in that off-Broadway world and do what I did. I felt like we were explorers on the edge of something very exciting that was happening in the theater. You know, Durang, Inarritu, all these absurdist modern plays about people in terrible situations in life who somehow keep going. I loved telling those stories, and the only place I could really do that was where I was.
Tell me about how you, you were approached to audition for this part, for this sci-fi film, Alien. An unknown director, Ridley Scott, he'd done one feature film, but basically unknown. And you, from what I understand, you were not particularly enthusiastic about the part. I mean, what do you remember about meeting him and talking about this potential role?
Well, first of all, I wasn't approached. You know, I finally had gotten an agent. Hmm. And this agent sent me out for basically, it's like, go and see this guy about this. And it was about the sci-fi story. I was sent the script and I read it, and it was, if you don't know what the alien looks like, you don't understand what a groundbreaking film is going to be. I mean, I pictured some big lug of yellow jello running around. And so when I got to my meeting with Ridley, you know, again, I was not enamored with film. So when I met Ridley, we had a frank talk about the script, which I had questions about. And luckily it was Ridley, because he's a very straightforward guy. And I remember the casting person over in the corner, she was trying to motion to me to not criticize the script as if I had to be all sweetness and light in order to get the part. But I thought, well, I want to know if this man sees the script the same way I do, that it's not perfect, that there are things that should be discussed. I mean, I basically came in like an English major and had a little, we had a little class about the script. I admired the structure of the script. And in any case, to my great surprise, maybe because I wasn't falling all over myself with the ambition to play this character, I was kind of really trying to see the story and understand the character. They wanted me, and the people who wrote the script, Walter Hill and David Giler, who became very good friends of mine, and they're wonderful writers, they really wanted me. And they had to fight for me because the studio wanted to give it to more of a name.
Yeah.
And I think even Ridley, who knows what he thought. I did end up doing a screen test in London, which was really fun because Ridley built a whole set for me. And for me, I thought, I'm so grateful for this because this can be my rehearsal. This can be my little run-through of the part. We'll do different scenes from different points in the story, and I'll be able to tell whether I could make a go of this or not, because I was enough from the theater that I felt I needed to have something like that to help me see what I should do. So when they actually offered me the part, I still had to kind of figure out, how am I going to do this? And luckily, it kind of came to me.
How did that come to you? I mean, you made that character, Ellen Ripley. You became Ellen Ripley. And of course, it was a risk. It was a risk for you because it could have been a disaster. This is your first film, really. It could have been...
It was a much smaller business back then.
Yeah.
So when you say it was a risk, it really... Yes, it would have been a risk for me artistically if I'd been terrible or if the movie had been terrible. But to me, it was... I liked risk. So yeah. Risk was not... did not put me off. In fact, that attracted me. The fact that it was an odd, strange script, the likes of which I'd never read, that all of that interested me. And I told myself not to worry about the fact that it was a film, that it was kind of an off-Broadway film. So it was still my world. And I told myself that I could play it. You know, it's very frustrating sometimes as a young actor that you don't get to play the big male parts like yeah. Henry V and things like that. You know, I played Goneril in King Lear. I didn't play King Lear. So not that I would have had the balls to play it at that point anyway. But I thought, well, this can be my breeches part, which is where the girl in Shakespeare puts on the boy's clothes and tells that story. And they get to be all these things that traditionally aren't what you're allowed to do. You get to carry on. You get to not give up. You get to lead. And I realized that Ripley was an opportunity for me to kind of have this adventure of playing that kind of part, the boy's role. And so I thought, oh, I like that idea. And I had a wonderful director in Ridley and... You know, I mean, the reason I think Ripley has resonated is it was a wonderful role that they created, Walter and David. You know, no one thought the girl would survive.
Yeah.
So I had that surprise. You know, it gave me a run-through. It gave me a line to start with as this very young, you know, ensign who was very by the book. And then all these things happen. By the end, she's just flying by the seat of her pants. You know, she's a completely instinctive being, an animal just like the creature itself. And so it's a great yarn, you know, and I believe in great yarns. And so when Jim Cameron came along and built yet another kind of story for Ripley, I think that's... what cemented her for people as a groundbreaking character.
Right. And James Cameron obviously directed Aliens, the sequel in 1986. And it was even more critically acclaimed than the first film, which is saying a lot. So when you took on this role, right, I mean, it was a groundbreaking character. I mean, it's credited with paving the way for Angelina Jolie and Tomb Raider, Jennifer Lawrence and Hunger Games. Today, you know, Scarlett Johansson and Gal Gadot and obviously, you know, Sarah Connor, the character of Sarah Connor. I mean, there have been these iconic roles, but Ellen Ripley is sort of one of the first really strong action heroines. Were you conscious of that at the time? I mean, did you feel that? Did you think, this is different? This is something... new.
What I felt was that Walter and David had done me the service of writing a part that was originally a man's part. Mm-hmm. They had created this part and they hadn't ruined it by making it a girly part. In other words, there was no sort of breakdown scene where Ripley has time to doubt herself or ask someone for help. They just wrote it like they would for a guy. And that in itself to me was revolutionary continued to be revolutionary because this was a time when if you did any kind of role at all, the business was saying, you have to be sympathetic. Mm. Women have to be sympathetic. And because it was science fiction, those rules did not apply. And so I was incredibly lucky to make my kind of debut in a realm that Hollywood wasn't that interested in. And so their stupid rules weren't relevant here. We could do our own thing in science fiction. And that's one reason why I think the space is so exciting.
Tell me how you began to sort of tap into who that character would be, right? Like, how did you find that character? Because that character could have been played by a dozen different actresses, and it would have been a different character depending on who played it. And of course, your role as Ellen Ripley is iconic. How do you remember sort of really understanding what you wanted to be in that role?
Well, I don't think I had any of that in mind. I think I was wanted to tell the story, wanted to figure out where I was in the story. I remember speaking to Ian Holm, who became a good friend of mine. I said, because this was right, you know, we were thrown immediately into these big scenes where Ian was the science officer. And I remember sitting in Ian's dressing room, we were talking about the story, and I said, gosh, do you think that Ripley knows she's right when she makes these calls? And Ian said, yeah, I think she does. And I said, you know, I don't think she does know she's right. She thinks she's right. She hopes she's right. But there's no real confidence in that. And I realized looking back that I was playing Ripley the way I was playing the part, which is, I don't know what I'm doing. Here comes a scene. I think the scene is about this. And so I'm going to do this. And it was all flying by the seat of your pants. It's all done with instinct, hope, my fingers crossed. And in fact, that is Ripley's story. She tries to put one foot in front of another until the whole thing escalates so that she's just running for her life. But I think what's interesting to me looking back is that I played it as someone who wasn't used to this kind of world, wasn't used to this kind of pressure, wasn't used to any of this, working out of chronology. So we don't do that in the theater.
Right. And when in a film, you film things out of sequence.
Completely out of sequence. It's all upside down. I really didn't know what I was doing the first week. I remember Ridley said, try not to look in the camera. And I said, well, I'm really happy not to look in the camera, but you keep putting it right in front of me, so I don't know where to look. So there were all these basic questions I had, and honestly, I just took it from day to day, and I feel very grateful that I had a wonderful director who kept telling me, you know, run down this corridor and do this and do that, and I just tried with all my wits to sort of be the person underneath that. And so I think I was very lucky that it was this story. When I got to Aliens, it was a much more sophisticated story in many ways. But by then, I was ready for it.
When that film came out to critical acclaim and you were nominated for a BAFTA for that role, did that voice in your head, that voice that was telling you you don't have the talent to be X, Y, or Z, did that go away? I mean, because at that point, I mean, it kind of opened the floodgates. I mean, you'd go on to do all these massive roles in the 1980s.
You know, I think that the teachers who were so nasty were fired when I graduated. And at some point, I received a letter of apology from the head of the school saying once he realized these people hated actors, he got rid of them. Too bad for my class and a couple of the other classes. But you know, I had to stop worrying about them. I realized that I had taken it too much to heart, that I actually had been doing quite well when I was told all these terrible things. And, you know, I just couldn't worry about it anymore. So I can't say that I said to myself, well, they were wrong. I just stopped being able to think about it because so much was going on. I remember when I was nominated for the Oscar for Aliens, I was in meetings for Gorillas in the Mist. So my only goal as an actor was to be someone people wanted to work with and to have one job lead to another. And I thought that that was about as fine an ambition as you could ever have.
When we come back after a short break, Sigourney Weaver explains how playing such a wide array of characters over the course of her career is actually fulfilling a dream she inherited from her mother. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to The Great Creators.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hey, welcome back to The Great Creators. I'm Guy Raz. Sigourney Weaver's played a staggering variety of characters. Lieutenant Ellen Ripley in the Alien films, Diane Fossey in Gorillas in the Mist, Catherine Parker in Working Girl, Janie Carver in The Ice Storm, Dr. Grace Augustine, the lead science officer in Avatar, and so many others. What draws you to particular characters? What do you look for? I mean, you've done such a massive range of personalities. What is it that you look for when you decide to embody this person who's not you?
Well, it's pretty simple. I still look for a story I'd want to see if I was going to the movie theater. So I don't want it to be some obscure, you know, sort of intellectual thing that I can't relate to. I want it to really have a beginning, middle, and end and be about something that's more important than the people in it. But secretly, I think when I was discouraged at Yale, I thought, well, this means I'll probably never do what my mother did, which she was an actress in a repertory theater, which I always thought was the most grand thing possible. And so in the back of my mind, I think I've always thought, this is my repertory theater, my career. I can use it, you know, so I'll play this maid in this comedy, and then I'll play the queen in this other genre, and I'll just keep skipping around as if I'm in a repertory theater of my own. And I think every time I do one thing, I want to hopscotch to the other side and do something completely different. I feel like the extremes that I jump to, they balance what I do in a kind of sane way.
You know, there's something that I read about, something you did in the early 90s. And this is after a string of massively successful roles, Academy Award nominations, Golden Globe wins, you know, acclaim. And in 1994, you were in this film, Death and the Maiden. This a Roman Polanski film, and it's set in a in a South American country after the fall of a dictator, and it's about a political activist named Pauline Escobar, played by you, who's convinced that that a guest in her home is a man who once tortured her during the dictatorship. And for that film, you actually started working with an acting coach, somebody named Jack Walter. And can you sort of talk a little bit about that? I mean, what was going on in your mind where you felt, you know, I need to kind of reapproach what I'm doing and sort of maybe, I don't know, start from scratch or learn a new technique, or what was it?
Well, it was Roman Polanski who brought Jack on. I think Roman, knowing the story he had to tell, he didn't have the time to sit down with me and help me develop the kind of backstory that Paulina needed. And even though I'd been working with a human rights group for a number of years and had met with people who had been in Argentina and Chile who were abused like this, I basically had led a very privileged life. Mm. And how could I possibly play Paulina? And so I was quite delighted that he brought in Jack. And Jack and I just spent hours and hours and hours every week during those 13 weeks, kind of. It was very actor's studio, which I'd never studied. It was Jack is a wonderful combination of different techniques from the actor's studio, sense memory and things like that. And we just really worked on bringing what I had experienced in my life together with what Paulina had experienced in her life in a usable way, so that I could find those extremes of feeling and experience and tell her story truthfully. So I'm very grateful to Roman for suggesting I work with Jack, and I worked with Jack on and off for the next few years, and I still use so much of the work we did. And then after a while, I realized that they always want to break stuff down at drama school and tell you to list your props and how you're going to use them and all this nonsense, you know. And as someone who is kind of very, I would say, very much in my head at the beginning, I more and more let all of that go and allow my instincts to work as an actor, and trust myself. I've done the work before I arrive on the set, and I have a lot of this in me now. And you know, they say it takes 20 years to become a good actor. I think that's probably very true. No matter how talented you are, and there are certainly people who are extremely talented, I think it takes at least 10 years before you just let it go. And yeah, you just let it go. Doesn't mean you don't do the work. You certainly do. I mean, I think you always have to be quite disciplined about how you show up to work. But you can also maybe let the reins go.
Who's an actor that you've worked with who really brings the best out in you as an actor?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. There's so many. I mean, I think all the actors I work with bring the best out in me, because I'm usually a member of a wonderful ensemble. And so you are so inspired by both the material and the talent of the people you're working with. And that's why I love film in a way. I love theater too, but it's always bringing your best to meet the other person's best that that makes it so exciting and joyful.
I was thinking maybe in part of Kevin Kline, who you've been in I think three films with, Dave, The Ice Storm, and the newest film, The Good House. So clearly there's a chemistry on screen between the characters that you play. What explains that? What explains, in your view, that feeling that you get as a viewer when you see two actors who really just are, it's just like a dance. They really understand the other performer and the other character.
It is a wonderful thing, and I do think Kevin Kline and I have this between us. We have a lot of fun working together. We trust each other. No matter what we throw at each other, that the other person can not only it feels very much like a trapeze act, where if I do a huge swing and let go, I know Kevin's going to catch me, and vice versa, I hope. Chemistry is one of those things that I don't think you can ordain. You either have it with people or you don't. I mean, in fact, it's sort of part of your job to create it. Find the things that do turn you on and excite you about the other person, especially if it's a love story. But you kind of have to fall in love with whoever you're playing opposite. Working with Kevin, I mean, sometimes we talk about what else we'd like to do. But that's just one of those crazy things. I think we were very lucky to have this particular story to tell, Good House, because we had a more happy love story in this, comparatively, certainly a lot happier than Ice Storm. We were delighted to be able to do this. And I think we do bring out the best in each other. And I'm very, very grateful, because it was a huge part for me, for his support. I really felt he was there for me. And having someone of his huge talent and all his gifts be there for me was a great support.
How do you, I mean, you've been in this industry for 50 years, right?
Have I? Is it that long?
Yeah, which is remarkable. I mean, you are so busy. You've got a new Avatar film coming out at the end of this year. You will be in the future Avatar films. You're committed to being in those films. How do you get better at what you do? Like, because nobody wants to keep doing something if they feel that they're not getting better at it, right? And so presumably you must feel that every time you take on a new role, you actually become a better actor. Do you feel that way?
Well, I think that's probably true. I'm sure that you feel with every interview you give.
I do.
You become more relaxed. You become more wise. You become more instinctive about where the conversation might go. So I think the same is true of what I do. I think most actors at this point aren't really thinking, how am I doing? I think we're just doing. And I celebrate the talent of all the women in my kind of grouping, like Meryl and Glenn. And, you know, we're just such an amazing batch of very talented artists.
Yeah.
And I think that's one reason why I am working, because there's so much talent that people are writing for. People have discovered that we geezers here in this business have a lot to offer, and that there are more interesting ways to tell stories than just having some, you know, caricature of an older woman who's a bad mother-in-law or something like that. You know, that if you look at great literature and great theater, older women's parts are always very important. And so, you know, you talk about longevity of career, but if you're coming from the theater, there have always been these incredible actresses and actors who have careers their entire lives. And the main challenge for us is to physically stay as strong and versatile as possible so that we can play these parts and do justice to them physically. A tremendous amount of stamina is needed, I think, to work in television or film or theater. And I think that's the greatest challenge for an older artist.
As I mentioned, you're committed to all of these Avatar films. I mean, you will be working for a long, long time.
I know.
which is remarkable for any actor's career, to be working for 50 years and to be active and to be really busy. I mean, when your sort of story is written, there inevitably people will talk about, you know, the roles that you had as a trailblazer and these sort of strong female leads and these action figures and these, you know, these very powerful characters that you embodied. And do you feel that is a, I mean, I could imagine you'd be proud of that legacy, but I guess I wonder, do you identify with that? Do you think this is really what I want to be known for? This is what I want people to remember me as, this person who created these characters, who brought them to life?
Well, you know, to me, the characters I play are not always strong. I often play women who are very isolated for some reason because of what they do, and they're very vulnerable. And so I guess the reason I keep doing what I'm doing is I really believe that women are very complex, and we're often in very vulnerable situations. Those are the stories that I like to tell because I consider that the truth. I don't consider them strong women. I consider them women because I think women are strong. And whatever liabilities you may have in your character, if you're in these extreme situations, you have to find the strength. You have to find the resolve. You have to find the courage. And so I think those are the stories that I like to play. And that's why when I think of who I'm doing this for, I think of a lone woman sitting in a movie theater. She's kind of crept out of her very busy life where she's taking care of everybody else. She's come to the theater to get out of her life. And I want to take her on a journey. I want to take her, give her something to think about and reflect on, maybe a wonderful adventure or whatever it is. I'm doing it for women because I just believe in us, and I never feel there are enough stories about how amazing women are.
That's Sigourney Weaver. Over the next few years, she's committed to appearing in several more Avatar films. And as you probably know, her character, Dr. Grace Augustine, died. So she's now playing a new character, a Na'vi teenager named Kiri, who's native to the moon of Pandora. And to prepare for the role, Sigourney had to learn how to hold her breath underwater for 6 minutes.
You put your face in the water, and you have a snorkel, and you allow the mammalian instinct in yourself to kind of retreat so that you can bring your more, I don't know, lizard-like self that likes being in the water. That's called a static breath hold.
You can find links to scenes from some of Sigourney's most iconic film roles in the show notes for this episode at our website, thegreatcreators.com/Weaver. And the show notes for every episode live at thegreatcreators.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Great Creators early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for listening to our episode this week. If you liked what you heard, we have one simple request. Please tell someone about it. Share a link or tweet or post a story in hashtag The Great Creators. You can find us on social media by searching The Great Creators. We're on Instagram at The Great Creators Podcast. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and I'm on TikTok as Guy Raz. So please do spread the word. This episode was produced by Bruce Wallace and edited by Jessica Diehl with help from Jeff Rogers. Thanks also to Kevin Leahy, Elaine Coates, Jenna Gedman, Nat Hoops, Rebecca Spiro, Michael May, Andrea Bruce, Michelle Triant, and Daniel Shukin. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to The Great Creators from Built It Productions.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.